You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 146, Ezekiel chapter 32. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, are you still snowed in?
We are not snowed in anymore. Thank goodness.
Good deal.
Yeah, the pug was getting sick of me, so.
Not the other way around.
But not the other way around. Nope. Hey. Nope. He's like, just get away from me. Go to work, you know?
Yeah, well, good deal. Well, hey, Mike, I wanted to mention Randall Price and him discovering and his team are all involved discovering a 12th Qumran cave, and they were successful. They didn't find anything, right?
Well, they found, you know, they found some pottery and they found some text fragments, but still that's a big deal to know that there's still other stuff there.
Yeah.
So yeah, kudos to him and whatever role, you know, he played in that process. I mean, there were a lot of hands in there, but yeah, it was nice to get that news.
Absolutely. That's pretty neat. All right, Mike, well, chapter 32 this week, huh?
Yep. Here we go with chapter 32 again, right on the heels of Ezekiel 31, which was the episode on the cosmic tree and why, you know, what that language means, why we have it, what's the point of it. In this chapter, Ezekiel 32, we have what probably in most study Bibles or, you know, most English translations will probably be labeled something like a lament over Pharaoh. But we want to again stress this isn't just about Pharaoh. It's a lament over Pharaoh and Egypt, the country itself. It starts out with Pharaoh as the focus, but then as you keep reading, like around verse 16, it expands to all Egypt and all their multitude. And you say, well, why is that important? Well, go listen to chapter 31, and you'll find out why I even point that out. This is not, again, just focused on one person. And again, there are reasons for that to emphasize it. But in this chapter, we're going to get this lament language, but there's going to be a few sort of oddities in this chapter. And I'm not going to read through the whole thing. It's longer than chapter 31 was, but I'm going to camp on a few things that I think would be of special interest, you know, for our audience. And so let's just jump in here. I'll read the first 7 or 8 verses, and then there's going to be one thing in here in particular that I want to spend some time on. And again, try to get people some scholarly information about if they're interested in it. So Ezekiel 32, a lament over Pharaoh and Egypt. In the 12th year, in the 12th month, on the first day of the month, the word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, raise a lamentation over Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and say to him, you consider yourself a lion of the nations, but you are like a dragon in the seas. You burst forth in your rivers, trouble the waters with your feet, and foul their rivers. Thus says the Lord God, I will throw my net over you with a host of many peoples, and they will haul you up in my dragnet, and I will cast you on the ground. On the open field I will fling you. I will cause all the birds of the heavens to settle on you. I will gorge the beasts of the whole earth with you. I will strew your flesh upon the mountains and fill the valleys with your carcass. I will drench the land, even to the mountains, with your flowing blood, and the ravines will be full of you. When I blot you out, I will cover the heavens and make their stars dark. I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon shall not give its light. All the bright lights of heaven I will make dark over you, and put darkness on your land, declares the Lord. Now that's the first 8 verses. And we get some celestial language in there that, again, is probably a reference, especially in an Egyptian context, to, again, the judgment of certain gods and whatnot, kind of like the plagues were. I mean, you get these points of connections, but the place I actually want to park on is a little odder than that, and that is early in the description. We have the odd combination here, at least it's seemed odd to lots of scholars, of a lion and a dragon. You say, well, those are two quite different things. You know, you consider yourself a lion of the nations, but you're like a dragon in the seas. Okay, and then the rest of it, you know, sort of picks up with God taking him out of the water and killing him and throwing the pieces all over the place, you know, all that sort of stuff. Now, we've seen this kind of thing already in Ezekiel in earlier chapters where we had this dragon, Tanim is the lemma, situation going on in relation to other oracles of the nations. And we talked about how this is part of the Leviathan complex of ideas, the chaos monster, the great chaos monster. And so it's kind of obvious if, you know, for our listeners who have been tracking through Ezekiel, and that kind of material is going to be familiar to them by this point, because it wasn't too long ago that we ran into that. But here we get that, plus we get this lion thing, and it just seems out of place. And so a lot of scholars have wondered, well, what's going on here? I mean, some scholars will even say there's an error here, or a textual error, and they'll try to change the text to, quote unquote, have it make more sense. That's a bit misguided. And for listeners who are really into this kind of thing and into this topic, and you can judge it after we, you know, go through it a little bit, I'm going to put in the folder, again, that's accessible to subscribers to my newsletter. Again, I have a specific link in the newsletter to a folder that lives, it's past, you know, it's protected online. You can't just find it, can't just go there on your own. You have to have the link to a place where I put peer-reviewed material that I discuss in a particular episode, so you can go read and get more detail. I'm gonna put in that folder this article. It's by Theodore Lewis, Ted Lewis, who's now at Johns Hopkins. When he wrote this, he was at Georgia. He's a Wisconsin grad for his MA anyway, so I know Ted peripherally. But his article is called CT, and that's Cuneiform Text, 13, lines 33 to 34, and Ezekiel 32, Lion Dragon Myths. It's from the Journal of the American Oriental Society back in 1996. Now, what this article is about, what Ted is going to do is he's going to go through Mesopotamian material, and specifically this one particular text, and he's going to show, you know, if you were a Mesopotamian or if you were familiar with Mesopotamian thinking, this combination of a lion and a dragon wouldn't be a conundrum. It's actually a familiar way to portray some things. Let me read the abstract, and then I'll read the first paragraph. I'm going to be skipping in and out of this article a little bit so you kind of get the feel for what Ted is doing in the article and also sort of the backdrop to this thinking about Egypt in Ezekiel 32. So the abstract says, this article presents the full text of CT 13, lines 33 and 34, a myth which describes a battle between Tishbak with a P, the chief god of Eshnunna, and a dragon serpent creature of immense proportions. It further explores the nature of this composite creature having both leonine and serpentine characteristics, including iconographic representations. So let me stop there. In the article, you know, Ted has a number of pictures of, you know, cylinder seals and whatnot, where you get this image of a lion-dragon combination. Back to Ted's abstract. The Canaanite background of the divine battle with the Tanin dragon creature found in Ezekiel 32 is also investigated in this article. A review of the history of scholarship shows that many have perceived the two parallel descriptions of Pharaoh as a lion and a dragon serpent to be incompatible. This paper argues that there is considerable textual and iconographical justification for associating these two creatures together as symbols of terrifying power. Now, he gets into the article, and he talks a little bit about, well, you know, some of you are probably thinking this is a, you know, like the Marduk text, Marduk fighting Tiamat. Again, this is one of the, this is Babylonian creation story where the god Marduk has to fight the great chaos serpent, which is called Tiamat there. In Canaanite texts, like at Ugarit, the battle of, in the sea, the battle of the sea between the deity and then the sea creature. The sea creature is called Leviathan or Lotan, or even Yam, which is a word that means sea in Ugaritic. So there you get different terms, but it's the same scene, the same idea that the god is going to have to subdue the forces of chaos for whatever purpose. So, you know, Ted talks about both of those that, you know, hey, you know, we're more familiar with these. They get a lot more press time because it's the Babylonian creation story, and then it's familiar from, you know, familiar text from Ugaritic stuff. And he's saying this text, which isn't known by a whole lot of people, really accomplishes the same thing, but it's special because you get the dragon described in lion terms. And so he, you know, wants to study this because this is just like Ezekiel 32. I mean, it has the same, again, the same sort of telegraphing the same symbology, again, the same descriptions, you know, as the text that he's focused on. So he says here, back to Ted's article, he says, the depiction of the dragon is as astonishing as are its proportions. In lines 5 and 6 of the text, he is clearly called a serpent. This is the cuneiform text now. An indication that we are not dealing with a simple serpent is found in lines 17, 20, and 24 on the obverse, and lines 4, 7, and 9 on the reverse. It's a tablet, so it has two sides. The creature there is called a labu, which is a common Akkadian word for lion. So part of the inscription, it's called a serpent. Another part of the inscription, it's called a lion. So he's like, hey, this is just like Ezekiel 32. Ted writes, the choice of the word labu with its leonine connotations is likely not accidental. I suggest returning to Heidel's notion. Heidel was a famous Assyriologist of, you know, era gone by. Heidel's notion of a composite monster or dragon with leonine and serpentine attributes. Then Ted references the work of Elizabeth D. Van Buren. And it, by the way, if you ever come across Elizabeth Van Buren's book, any of her books on iconography, buy them. She is like the leading person on this, but her books are really, really hard to find because they're older, they're out of print. And if you ever, if you're into this stuff, that's just one of the things to have. Plus, she writes in English. It's not German. Really good stuff to have. But Van Buren's conclusion is that, quote, dragons of later ages all derive from two main types, the leonine and the ophidian. Ophidian is an academic term for serpentine. So Van Buren, who focused her whole academic career on Mesopotamian iconography, art, okay, she says, basically, you got two kinds of dragons in this material. You get one that looks like a snake. You get another one that's described in lion terms. And occasionally, those two things are put together. Lewis references the Gilgamesh epic. Okay, there's a snake. You know, well, I'll just read it to you. He says, the juxtaposition of serpent and lion reminds us of the snake who steals the plant of life in the Gilgamesh epic, who is also called a Nesu-sa-kakari, a lion of the ground. Again, he's saying, look, even in Gilgamesh, you get this combination. Iconographic representations show that the lion and the serpent dragon were so closely associated that they could actually be combined into a single composite creature. Several archaic Mesopotamian cylinder seal impressions, again, he has those pictures in his article, represent paired fantastic creatures with lions' bodies and heads, yet long intertwined serpentine necks. And a lot of listeners are going to have seen these pictures, you know, on the internet or whatever, you know, usually associated with something goofy like, oh, we've got, you know, lion-snake hybrids in the ancient world. They were doing genetics. And no, that isn't the point at all. Again, this is why I'm exposing you to Lewis. And of course, if you find, you know, Van Buren's work, it's just awesome because this is all she did. You know, it's not about genetics. It's about metaphor. It's about the combination of metaphors to telegraph certain ideas. Again, drawn from two animals that could easily be and often were talked about and their physical properties, their physical abilities, and even their appearance, you know, were drawn on repeatedly to describe, you know, something to be feared, something fearful, something that's hostile, the forces of chaos against the things that make our life difficult when the gods want us to have a nice ordered life. Okay. This kind of thinking, people in the ancient world would draw on animal motifs to express these ideas. They were very useful. They were very common. Everybody would know what you're talking about when you did this. And occasionally, again, in the artwork, since both lion motifs and serpent motifs were used to describe, again, chaotic forces, sometimes they just combined them. And again, people would understand what's going on because they're both used that way separately. So let's just bring them together and create a composite. It's not about, you know, doing weird genetics. Okay. We're not, you know, shout out to, you know, Christian Middle Earth here. This is not what it's about. Okay, it's about something different. Lewis references another example. You can actually see this on something called the Narmer palette, which is an Egyptian object. Again, it kind of looks like a black stone shield. It has, again, this bodies of the lions, the long serpentine necks on it. It's pretty familiar. You can probably find a lot of this stuff on the internet, and many of the listeners probably have already. So what Lewis's article does, and again, I'm giving it to you. I'm not going to, you know, go through the whole thing here, obviously. But if you want examples of this, and again, what meanings would have been attached to it, this is an excellent resource. Again, because what he's going to do is he's going to go through the Mesopotamian material, and then he's going to start talking about Ezekiel 32, okay, and how this helps us understand what Ezekiel's doing. Again, he's in Babylon, right? This is where he's writing. This is, you know, his context, but he's also talking about Egypt. So it's kind of significant that both to an Egyptian and to a Babylonian, this mixture of lion, serpent, artwork, motif, attributes, characteristics, that sort of thing, it's going to be familiar to both crowds, both contexts, and it's also going to be familiar to Israelites, mostly because of the chaos dragon idea that we've talked about before. So let me just pull out a few other things that Lewis has to say here. He says, the dragons churning in the waters in Ezekiel 32, verse 2, is found also at Ugarit. The enmeshing of the dragon in 32:3, again, captured in a net, reminds one of Marduk's battle against Tiamat, again, because that happens, you know, in that episode. The use of the slain carcass as food for birds and beasts in Ezekiel 32:4 finds a direct parallel in the Tanin Leviathan passage of Psalm 74. The size of the dragon mentioned in Ezekiel 32:5-6 is described by Eichrode, another scholar, as, quote, being so enormous that its decaying masses fill the mountains and valleys, and its lifeblood floods the earth and causes a spate in the watercourses, unquote. This, too, is reminiscent of Tiamat's huge carcass, out of which Marduk is able to fashion heaven and earth. The Tanin creature in Ezekiel 32:2, again, the dragon creature, occurs frequently in the Bible, including the parallel passage of Ezekiel 29. Of course, this is where we first encountered it in the podcast. You get, again, the reference to the chaos dragon there. You can go back and listen to the episode where we covered chapter 29. But Lewis says, a study of the descriptions of this creature reveals a mixing of dragon and lion imagery. The Tanin is much more than a serpent, and it's not just the crocodile of outdated scholarship. This dragon creature, occurring in parallel to Yam, to the sea, in Job 7:12, and Leviathan in Psalm 74:13 and Isaiah 27:1, and Rahab in Isaiah 51, verse 9, is, of course, slain by Yahweh, the divine warrior. So again, Lewis just takes you through these passages. Again, we've discussed several of them on the podcast. And the point here, again, and if you listen to the previous episode, chapter 31, you know, I kind of harped on this a lot and told you the reasons why and encouraged you to even go back to Ezekiel 28. But the point here is that Pharaoh, even though the Ezekiel 32 starts out with raise a lamentation over Pharaoh, king of Egypt, the point of the analogy is not that Pharaoh is being compared to a man, okay, who fell. Here, it's so obvious. The point of the analogy is that Pharaoh is being compared to what? To supernatural opposition to Yahweh's order. He's being compared to supernatural forces that fight against Yahweh's ordered world. And just like chapter 31, we have supernatural upheaval in the divine council. Same in chapter 28, same in Isaiah 14, same in Genesis, you know, all these passages again. These empires, these nations that are allotted to other gods, and those gods are hostile to Yahweh. They don't want the restoration of Eden. They don't want Yahweh's good order on earth. They oppose these things. They are therefore consistently analogized to rebellion against Yahweh's will from the very beginning, back in primeval days. Okay, it's not just about one guy, Adam, in Eden. It's so much bigger than that. These nations, allotted to other gods who are now hostile to Yahweh, their rebellious status, their rebellious stance, their opposition to what God wants to do with Israel to reestablish the kingdom, which is Eden, on earth, makes them prime fodder to be compared to the original rebellion in the divine council at the beginning of God's good world. The analogy is very clear. It's not just about humanity losing immortality. It's about forces that are cosmic in nature rising up against the Most High God, and the Most High God having to deal with it. And it plays out on Earth because that's what the battle is for. It plays out, you know, with these nations, we're in the Oracles Against the Nations section. It plays out on Earth among these nations because the nations have to be brought under order. The gods, the hostile forces that empower them, that rule them through worldly empires like Assyria and Tyre and Egypt and Babylon. These forces must be brought under control, and the forces that govern them ultimately, again, we've done a lot of material on this in the podcast and, of course, Unseen Realm. Those gods are ultimately going to be dealt with and their authority taken away. Now, that's associated with the resurrection in the New Testament. You can reference the episode we did on the death of the gods and the resurrection. But all of this now, again, this judgment of the nations now, because of what that whole situation represents, being the force of chaos against what God wants to do and what God wants to restore to get back to Eden, back to his kingdom. Of course, the best point of analogy is not one man who loses immortality. It's against a rebellion that's even bigger, because that man wouldn't have rebelled had not someone from the divine council interfered with Eve and Adam to get them to come over to the side of rebellion. Okay, it's much bigger than that. You can't just deal with the problem of death and mortality and fix the world. You must deal with divine rebellion as well. Again, this is the part in our theology that we completely overlook. We are so fixated on the fall and on Adam and Eve and our own condition that we fail to see that if you ask, again, an Israelite, why is the world the way it is? The fall is going to be part of that picture, but it's also going to be Genesis 6. It's also going to be what happens at Babel with the nations, the allotment of the other gods, and the disinheritance, the divorcing of the other nations, making them non-family members. All of this needs to be dealt with. And so the point of these analogies is never just this one guy in the garden. It's cosmic. And this is so well illustrated in Ezekiel 32, because now when Egypt is compared to something, in chapter 31, it was the great tree, which is not Adam. Okay, it's not Adam. It's a member of the council, like we talked about last time. And if you've read Lipinski's article from last episode, you see how flawed the typical approach is. Okay, in chapter 32, it's obviously not one man. It's the forces of chaos. Egypt is compared not to a man or a single tree or whatever. He's compared, and the nation is compared, to the forces of chaos, to the lion dragon of the seas. All of the stuff that opposes God, which includes, encompasses, you know, the supernatural, because it's a supernatural metaphor. We're not talking about a real lion. We're not talking about a real lion dragon. There are no dragons whose carcass is as big as mountains, okay? We're talking about a supernatural, cosmic, theological, religious, you know, metaphor to illustrate not, hey, there's a problem with mortality that we need to fix. No, there's a problem with disorder in the very fabric of creation that is attributable to a series of rebellions that began in primeval history all the way forward. And it's so much bigger than what commentators will typically fixate on. We are not dealing with Adam, and we haven't been dealing with Adam. It's just much bigger. Now, back to Lewis's article, he says, when he starts to summarize things, he says, the cuneiform text 13 that he's talking about and Ezekiel 32 contains similar images. Both deities direct their attacks against antagonists portrayed with leonine and serpent dragon imagery. Tishpach's dragon, again, Tishpach is the deity in this cuneiform text, is a water creature, the, quote, offspring of the river, of immense proportions, especially in length. Likewise, the dragon Yahweh battles as a water creature, Ezekiel 32:2, of enormous size, whose carcass is so huge it fills mountains and valleys. That's verses 5 and 6 of Ezekiel 32. In particular, the oracles against Egypt, this is four chapters in Ezekiel, chapters 29 through 32, are connected with a specific pharaoh, somebody who's alive during Ezekiel's, you know, period that people can understand it, whose name was Hophra, who was known historically for challenging Nebuchadnezzar. In Jeremiah 37:5, we get a reference there. Ezekiel illustrates how Hophra's hubris, like that of the king of Tyre, proves his demise. Again, you're not going to get away with this. You're nothing special. You're nothing special. You know, in fact, look at the theological messaging. God is saying, look, this is how I look at you. I look at you as a force of chaos. You and your empire, you know, the Egyptians, the whole system. You're a force of chaos. And I'm about dealing with chaos. What I want to do with my world is more than give humanity a cure for what ails them. Again, the problem of death. I want everything restored to its original, pristine, orderly state. Okay, I want my household restored, because ultimately I'm going to make the earth, the whole earth, not just a garden, the whole earth my household. So this is a lot bigger than you. You're nothing special. And frankly, God is saying, I can handle the work. Okay, my enemies are a lot bigger than you are. And I'm going to deal with them. I'm both dealing with them now, because you remember the Assyrians? They're not so much of a big deal anymore. Them and their gods, they've been put in their place. You know, and Tyre, and you know, now you're the Egyptians, and I'm going to get to the Babylonians. Again, ultimately, we know, because we have the event of the cross, we have the event of, you know, we have the New Testament, we have the event of the resurrection, we have all this stuff, that the ultimate defeat of all of these things and the ultimate restoration to order of all of these things is linked to the death, burial, and resurrection of the Messiah, who was Yahweh as a man on earth to accomplish these things. Ezekiel doesn't know that yet, okay? But we know that. And so this is the beginning. This judgment of the nations language is the beginning of saying, look, yeah, my people are in exile because they were awful. They were disloyal to me and my covenant, blah, 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 blah. And all these nations have been beaten up on them for, you know, for X number of years. And I'm even going to use the Babylonians to punish my own people. But I'm going to take care of all this. This is why the day of the Lord, again, the resurrection language in the New Testament, the messaging is, I am not just the Messiah for Israel. I am not just here to give people a home in heaven, okay, to take care of the death problem. I am here because I am reclaiming all of it. Every square inch, nothing is going to be missed. And this kind of talk, judging the nations, is the beginning of that. It foreshadows and puts those things into motion. Of course, you know, it really takes momentum when we get to the cross event. But that's again, all of this is a precursor to that. So again, Lewis is saying, you know, this is just bigger than, you know, one or two people, you know, somebody on earth. He says here, here's another little section. Ezekiel's portrayal of God's battle against Hophra, the Pharaoh at the time, was not written to underscore a Davidic ruler's claim to the throne. Not just that, but the preeminence. Here's the bigger point. The preeminence of Yahweh as sovereign God and divine warrior in contrast to all others, deities or mere human potentates like Pharaoh. The reason for the destruction of Egypt, as the author repeatedly emphasized using characteristic terminology, is so that all nations, everyone, including Egypt, may know that, quote, I am Yahweh, I am the Lord. Okay, it's just much bigger than you know, this isolated, you know, situation with Egypt. Now, another thing I want to say in regard to chapter 32, because you know we have the first eight verses there, the lion, the serpent imagery, the chaos dragon, that whole thing again. When we get out of verse 8, we get into another description of how badly God is going to judge Egypt. Verse 11, thus says the Lord God, the sword of the king of Babylon shall come upon you. I will cause your multitude to fall by the swords of mighty ones, all of them, you know, the most ruthless of nations, so on and so forth. So it's a description of beating up on Egypt. We've had this many times. So I'm not going to camp on that. Instead, I'm going to go to, let's start in verse 16. Okay. And read a section here. He says, this is a lamentation that shall be chanted. The daughters of the nation shall chant it over Egypt. Again, it's not just Pharaoh. Over Egypt and over all her multitude shall they chant it, declares the Lord God. In the 12th year, in the 12th month, on the 15th day of the month, the word of the Lord came to me, son of man, wail over the multitude of Egypt and send them down, her and her daughters of majestic nations, to the world below. To those who have gone down to the pits, and now we're getting the Sheol language again, the underworld. Verse 19, whom do you surpass in beauty? Go down and be laid to rest with the uncircumcised. Okay. Again, this would have been particularly frightening to the Egyptians because their view of the afterlife, kind of uniquely, was pretty positive. Again, it's not egalitarian initially in Egyptian religion. You get, you know, the afterlife is a wonderful place, but basically, it's for Pharaoh, you know, and whoever Pharaoh likes. Gradually, in Egyptian religion, this widens; it becomes more democratic. So the Egyptians again have, you know, more than other nations around them, have a fairly positive view of the afterlife. You know, not something to be, you know, really fearful about. So when they hear this kind of stuff again, and they see the Babylonians kicking their butts. And you have, you know, Ezekiel and other Israelite prophets running around saying, we told you so. You're nothing special. Okay, God used Babylon to judge us. He's going to use Babylon to judge you. Just like we were predicting to our own people this is going to happen, guess what? You're next in line. And then when we get out of chapter 32 in the book of Ezekiel, the message is going to transition to, well, you just got destroyed, but guess what? We're in bad shape now, but we will rise again. Our nation will rise again because we are the people of God. You know, Yahweh is not done with us. So if you're on the other side of that, if you're not included in Israel, this is going to be scary because you're going to see it happening sort of around you. And your positive view of the afterlife, you're going to call into question because, well, you know, boy, there's some people over in Israel that kind of knew this was going to happen. And that's just sort of freaking us out. Now, verse 21, let's just go to verse 20. That's where we left off. They shall fall amid those who are slain by the sword. Egypt is delivered to the sword. Drag her away and all her multitudes. And now we get into a section that I want to say a few things about because we get sort of underworld language and some description here and some interesting terms. Verse 21, the mighty chiefs, this is ESV now, the mighty chiefs, the word there is Gibborim. Just store that away because that's one of the words used in Genesis 6:4, the mighty men. Okay, here we have ESV has mighty chiefs. The Gibborim shall speak of them with their helpers. Out of the midst of Sheol, they have come down. They lie still, the uncircumcised, slain by the sword. Now, that language is very similar to Isaiah 14. Let me just refresh your memories there. And again, it's not just Isaiah 14, but you get other passages, the ones we've been talking about on the podcast with the oracles of the nations. But here we go in verse Isaiah 14:12. How are you fallen from heaven, O day star, son of the dawn? You're cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low. Again, you know, you weren't special. You know, verse 13, you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven above the stars of God. You know, I'll set my throne on high. I'll sit in the mount of assembly. I'm going to be Lord of the divine council, all this kind of stuff. But then when we get down to verse 15, you are brought down to Sheol, to the far reaches of the pit. Those who see you will stare at you and ponder over you. Is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a desert? And again, comparing the focus of the chapter is about the king of Babylon, so on and so forth. So Babylon's going to get judged. We have the same kind of language cast down, verse 19, away from your grave. You're going to be loathed like a branch. You're clothed with the slain, those who are pierced by the sword, who go down to the stones of the pit like a dead body trampled underfoot. I mean, this is Isaiah 14. So let's go back to Ezekiel 32. You get the same kind of language about, hey, you're going to wind up in Sheol where all these other uncircumcised are, slain by the sword. Okay, you're going to have the same fate. So Ezekiel writing here about the Egyptians, Isaiah writing about, you know, the Babylonians. So same thing. Again, just store this away. Let's talk about some of the things that are actually in this verse, and then we'll move on. Because in verse 22, we're going to throw Assyria into the mix. Again, all the empires, all the forces that oppose God, all the nations that oppose God are going to wind up in the same place. Okay, they're going to wind up in Sheol. They're going to wind up in the underworld. And you're not going to rise again. Okay, that's the larger point. So let's go look at verse 21. We have a reference to the Gibborim, okay? They're going to speak to the Egyptians that are going to wind up there out of the midst of Sheol. They've gone down there. Again, they still lie there. They're the uncircumcised slain by the sword. Now, the uncircumcised, being buried with the uncircumcised, could refer to several things. Obviously, it could be non-Israelite enemies in Sheol. Because, again, if you're going to stay in the bad place, you're going to stay dead. You're going to stay in the realm of the dead if you're not the people of God. If you're not a member of God's family, this is where you're going to stay. This is the Old Testament theology. And of course, we living, you know, after the cross with the New Testament, we get the point. You have to be in God's family. You have to be in New Testament language, united, you know, to him, you know, part of the body of Christ and all that stuff to escape death. Okay, we get this. But if you're not part of that family, this is where you're going to stay. Okay, you're going to stay in the realm of the dead. You're going to always be dead. You're not going to rise. Yeah, we get that. So it could be thinking about that. Again, non-Israelite destiny and Sheol. It could also refer to, more simply, to an Israelite audience. To the fear of, again, not just winding up in Sheol, because, hey, yeah, we're Israelites, but we still have to believe. We still have to be faithful to Yahweh, and we have to believe in him and all this sort of stuff. It's not just salvation by ethnicity. So, yeah, it could refer to staying in Sheol, but it's even worse than that, because in the realm of the dead, hey, we'll at least get to see mom and dad. We'll at least get to see the point here could be you're going to lie with the uncircumcised. You're not going to see your family members. You're going to be isolated. And in fact, you're going to be with people that you consider your enemies that hate you. And they, you know, you hate them, they hate you. In other words, it's just making a bad picture even worse. And you don't have this reunion kind of thing that, you know, the ancient people were expecting. You have the biblical expression, I'm going to go see my fathers. I'm going to be buried with my fathers. And, you know, we've talked about this before on the podcast that, you know, Israelites would bury their dead with things that they would use in the afterlife. There was a strong afterlife belief. You're going to get to be with your family, you know, and all that sort of, you know, now you hope that you're all going to wind up being taken out of Sheol by Yahweh, and you'll be at his side and all that sort of thing. And I've blogged extensively on this. There's more afterlife thinking going on in the Old Testament than a lot of people realize, but this just makes it worse. No, you're not going to get to do any of that. You're going to be buried with the people you hate, that are not part of your family. You know, you don't have any relief there at all. Now, Alan has something interesting to say here. He says the reference to those slain by the sword, together with the mention of the uncircumcised, again suggests a grimmer experience in the afterlife than most underwent. It could be argued because of, again, what archaeologists have discovered about Israelite burials. And not in just in Israelite culture, but other cultures. It could be a reference to other groups being separated out so that you won't be reunited with loved ones in other ways. For instance, there is evidence that infants who died before they were circumcised were buried separately in Israelite burials. It gave rise to the notion that, you know, they were in a separate place in Sheol because they had not been circumcised yet. Some Jews believe that. Some Israelites believe that. So the thing to catch here is separation from loved ones, which makes it just an awful thought. And you have no hope of anything positive at all, you know, in this cadaverous existence of the underworld. You don't even get to see, you know, your child or anything like that. So painting a really dark picture. Other scholars think that there was a separate, this is just sort of an add-on here, but other scholars think there was a separate place in the underworld for people who died violently. They were treated differently in burial in some cases in ancient Israel, so it reflects this idea. But the fundamental point to take away is that, you know, especially if he's speaking to the Egyptians and about the Egyptians, but the Israelites are going to catch the drift too. If you're judged by Yahweh, you're not part of the righteous remnant. Yeah, you're going to spend your whole time in Sheol, but you're going to be separated from the people you care about. and the people you love. Again, just trying to make a bad picture even worse. Verse 22, Assyria is there. Okay, targeting back to chapter 31, Assyria was brought up as, you think you're special, look at what happened to the Assyrians. Okay, Assyria is there in Sheol, and all her company, its graves all around it, all of them slain, all of them fallen. And here we get the Hebrew word Nophilim. All of them fallen, Nophilim, by the sword, Bekerav, okay? Whose graves are set in the uttermost part of the pit, and her company is all around her, all of them slain, all of them fallen, Nophilim, by the sword, who spread terror in the land of the living. Now here, this is verse 24, we have a reference to the fallen. This is actually a good place to point people to who say, well, Nephilim just means the fallen ones. Well, actually, if that was the point, you would spell it Nophilim, just like it's found here. This is what the scribes did with it. It's not what we get in Genesis 6. We have a reference here, and we even have the little phrase attached to it, by the sword. This is how you would spell fallen ones, those who have fallen in battle, or those who fall upon someone else. I point this out because these are the explanations that some people try to offer to get away from Nephilim in Genesis 6 being giants. Okay, that is not the way the text is pointed. It's not the way it's given to us. And I have a whole technical discussion of this in Unseen Realm, but since we're running into it here you have the textbook examples. This is how you would spell the term if you were talking about just normal human warriors in Genesis 6:4 and nothing more. But that isn't what you have. You don't have that spelling here. You know, Nephilim is different than Nophilim. The scribes knew what they were doing here. They deliberately spelled it one way in one passage and another way in another passage. And it's not legitimate to take the way it's spelled here and say, oh, that's what it means back in Genesis 6:4. Sorry, you don't get to do that. You don't just get to change the way the word is treated because it helps your theology or it doesn't disturb you with having giants, supernatural, quasi-supernatural beings in Genesis 6:4. You don't get to cheat, in other words. Now, I'll also say this, though. Because of what we do have here in Ezekiel 32, verses, you know, again, 21 through 23 here, it's very clear that the Nophilim are those who have fallen by the sword. There's no suggestion here that we have giants. There's no suggestion here that we have supernatural beings like we do in Genesis 6. So the argument it cuts both ways. I don't believe that this passage really gives us much information about the disembodied non-human dead. In other words, Old Testament antecedents to demons, the spirits of dead Nephilim. I don't think that's what's in view here because the text doesn't support it. The text clearly has those who Nophilim Bekerav, those who are fallen by the sword. It's just a reference to warriors. There's nothing, you know, overtly supernatural here. Now, if the term Rephaim occurred in this passage, I would think differently. Because the Rephaim, again, shows up, they show up, the shades of the Rephaim show up in underworld descriptions in other passages. We just don't have that here. Rephaim is absent from Ezekiel 32. So I don't think that these verses, Ezekiel 32 verses 21 through 24 or whatever, are talking about the disembodied Nephilim spirits that are part of Sheol. You got to go to other passages to get that. I'm just trying to be consistent with what's in the text. You don't have Rephaim referenced here, and you do not have Nephilim. You have Nophilim Bekerav, fallen by the sword. It's a clear reference to human warriors that were killed in battle. So I don't think you can make that argument here. You can make it in other places, but not here. Verse 24, it continues. Elam is there, all her multitudes around a grave, all of them slain, all of them fallen, Nophilim by the sword, who went down uncircumcised into the world below and spread terror in the land of the living. Now some would say, well, boy, that sounds like the fallen ones, the Nophilim, and people want them to be Nephilim here. they're running around now. They're running around after they were killed, spreading terror in the land of the living. That's just like what demons did. Well, the problem is you can't say that grammatically. You can't say that based upon the Hebrew verbs that are here. These are perfect, you know, sorry to lapse into the Hebrew here, but these are cal perfect and other perfect verbs, perfect conjugation. And perfectivity in Hebrew grammar, it's a grammatical term that refers to viewing a situation from the outside as whole and as complete. In other words, when Ezekiel's writing this, this is something that isn't happening after these Gibborim get slain, and then their spirits are released, and they go harass people like demons. This is something that he's viewing as already happened. So in other words, they're already dead. They're already down there in Sheol because they did this, because they were spreading terror in the land of the living. That's why they were judged. That's why they were killed and sent to the pit. It's not something they do after they were sent to the pit. It's something that's a reason for why they're down there. They are the uncircumcised enemy. They're judged. They're in Sheol. They're the slain. You know, they're in the pit. Now, again, the grammar is clear. The spelling of the term is clear. But when you get to verse 26, this is where scholars get a lot of fodder for, I shouldn't say scholars, because scholars know the difference, but a lot of popular discussion about Ezekiel 32 being about dead Nephilim spirits. Listen to verse 26. Meshech Tubal is also there, you know, in Sheol with all the rest of these nations. Meshech Tubal is there in all her multitude, her graves all around it, all of them uncircumcised, slain by the sword, for they spread their terror in the land of the living. So they're there because, for, key is the Hebrew term there, because they were spreading terror in the land of the living. You say, well, that sounds just like what you were saying, you know, Mike. Yeah, it sure does, but now listen to the next line. They do not lie with the mighty, the fallen, from among the uncircumcised who went down to Sheol. They do not lie there with the Gibborim, no Phileem. This is unusual because it has Gibborim, and then you have the consonants that spell out Nephilim. You have these two terms occur in the same verse, and the only other place that happens is Genesis 6:4. So a lot of people say, aha, we've got the two terms that appear in Genesis 6:4, they appear right here side by side in verse 27. We must be talking about the Nephilim here. Again, There are lots of problems with that. Let me read the rest of the verse. See if you catch the picture before we discuss it. Meshech and Tubal and all her multitude, they don't lie with the mighty, with the Gibborim, no Phileem. They don't lie with the mighty, the fallen from among the uncircumcised, who went down to Sheol with their weapons of war, whose swords are laid under their heads, and whose iniquities are upon their bones. For the terror of the mighty was in the land of the living. But as for you, you shall be broken and lie with the uncircumcised, those who are slain by the sword. You see the point? Meshech and Tubal don't lie with the Gibborim and the Nephilim, that some people want to say Nephilim. In verse 28, they're going to lie with the uncircumcised. But the Gibborim and the Nephilim here, they're different than the uncircumcised. They're different because they died in honor. They went down to Sheol with their weapons of war. They had their swords laid under their heads. These are descriptions of how you bury good soldiers, how you bury the honored dead. There's no way in Israelite thinking that the Gibborim and the Nephilim of Genesis 6:4 would have been viewed as honorable dead. So right, the description alone disconnects them. Disconnects the terms from that verse because they were the problem. If anybody was dishonorable, it would have been those guys because they spawned, again, the historic enemies of the Israelites who were bent on their annihilation. So you have a problem there. You say, well, what about iniquities are upon their bones? Well, I'm going to read you what Greenberg says because I agree with it. This is his Anchor Bible commentary. He says, again, whose iniquities were upon their bones, he writes. This is an obscure expression, since it is the result of their terrorizing. In the next clause, it may refer to some visible stigma on their limbs of punishment. However, Cornhill, who is another Old Testament commentator, felicitously emended the text. He changes the text from their iniquities to their shields. In other words, their shields are on their bodies. They're not bearing their iniquities, they're bearing their shields, which makes a lot of sense with swords being laid under their heads and all that stuff. You say, well, that's not fair. You can't just change the text. Well, here's what it's based on. The word for their iniquities begins with, in Hebrew, an ayin. It's ayin, vav, nun, tav, mem, their iniquities. The letter ayin is very similar to the letter tsade in Hebrew, especially in like Dead Sea Scrolls. They're very hard to distinguish. So if you assume that the scribe made a mistake and put ayin there, and you swap in tsade, you get the word shields. And I suspect that Cornhill is right, because, again, it makes really good sense in context, and it makes sense, you know, in the whole paragraph, that Meshach and Tubal are not going to be buried. They're on, you know, all of them. They're the uncircumcised. They're the jerks, okay? They're slain by the sword. They deserve to be in Sheol. They do not lie, verse 27. They do not lie with the mighty, with the fallen, from among the uncircumcised, you know, the ones who are, you know, again, distinct from them. They don't lie with them. These are the ones who went down to Sheol with their weapons of war, with the swords under their heads, with their shields, you know, with their bones. They were buried with honors. So they're not going to lie with those guys. And I think that makes a lot of sense. Nephilim, it's the same spelling. It's not Nephilim in Ezekiel 32:27. So again, I don't think Ezekiel 32 can really be used. Here's the point to all of this. I don't think this section of Ezekiel 32 can be used to give us much information about the disembodied non-human dead, the origin of demons. Yeah, I just don't think Ezekiel 32 helps us much with that. To me, it's pretty clearly about the human dead, some of them honorable, some of them dishonorable. All the human dead go to the same place. You die, you go to the underworld, okay? But there are honorable, you know, dead, and there are bad guys, okay? And so I think that's what it's about. And Egypt and Assyria, you know, Meshach, Tubal, Elam, all of them, Egypt is going to join in with the company who are buried among the uncircumcised. They are not honorable. That's where they're going to wind up. They're going to be part of the swelling mass of dishonorable dead that are going to spend eternity in Sheol. And I think that's the point. So I don't think we can use this passage, you know, to really say much about, you know, the Nephilim and the origin of demons. I think other passages you have to go to, like Job 26, you know, Isaiah 14, again, you get references to the Rephaim in these passages. And the Rephaim are clearly something that is associated with the giants. It's the same word, the same spelling in those passages as it is in Deuteronomy 2 and 3. Okay, you do not have that here with Nephilim. It's spelled Nephilim here. It is not Nephilim from Genesis 6. And Giborim, as I pointed out in Unseen Realm, is not a term that inherently means giant, even though it's used in Genesis 6:4. David is described as a Gibor in certain passages. God himself is described as a Gibor. Remember Isaiah 9? His name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God. It's El Gibor. Okay, Gibor does not inherently refer to giants and spawn of the sons of God, the fallen watchers. It just doesn't. But there are a lot of people out there who assume this and teach this, and again, use, you know, this passage, I think, incorrectly. So I wanted to belabor the point a little bit, even though it gets into the little nuts and bolts details of the text. You do not have the same term spelling for Nephilim as you do in Genesis 6:4. That's point number one. Point number two, Giborim does not necessarily mean giants. And point number three, the Rephaim are never mentioned in Ezekiel 32. So you've got 3 points of disconnect. again, to do any talk about the origin of demons from this particular passage. You got to go elsewhere for that. So let's move on toward the end of the chapter here, and we'll wrap up in verse 31. Again, the whole point of all this is, again, is that Pharaoh, the Egyptians, you're going to be like the Assyrians. You're going to be like the Elamites. You know, you're going to be like Meshach and Tubal. You're going to be like all these other dishonorable enemies of mine, says the Lord. I am going to send you, I'm going to give you a one-way ticket to Sheol, and that is where you're going to stay. And it's really a good setup, again, because of what's going to happen later. So in verse 31, when Pharaoh sees them, he will, you know, be comforted in the ESV. Again, it's the same terminology that we talked about last time in the last chapter. This lemma can be translated filled with remorse, which is a much better translation here. So I think the ESV messes this up. When Pharaoh sees them, he's not going to be comforted that the masses of his people got killed. How does that make any sense? No. He's going to be filled, again, with regret. He's going to be filled with remorse. Pharaoh and all his army, slain by the sword, declares the Lord God. For I, God says, I will spread terror in the land of the living. In other words, you terrorized everybody. I'm going to terrorize you. And he, Pharaoh, again, and his multitude, shall be laid to rest among the uncircumcised, among the people who are not my people. Okay, they're going to be laid to rest. That positive afterlife that Pharaoh's looking for in Egyptian religion, that positive afterlife that the Egyptians think is going to come to them, forget that. He is going to be laid to rest among the rest of the uncircumcised, those who are slain by the sword. Pharaoh and all his multitude, declares the Lord God. And that is how the chapter ends. This is not good news, again, for the Egyptians. But again, it's the one-way ticket to Sheol. These are not my people. They are never going to, they're going to be, this is their destiny. And in chapter 33, which is the subject of the next episode, we get the discussion of Ezekiel being Israel's watchman. The fugitive, you know, is going to come to him and report, hey, Jerusalem has fallen, and all this stuff. And that is going to create a transition point. It's going to create a transition point to, okay, what I just said was going to happen to you has happened. And God is bringing judgment, not just against the city, not just against the temple, but hey, there's still people back here in Babylon. I'm here among the captives. God is cleaning house, and he's about to make sure that the people who rule you, the shepherds of Israel, is how it's described in chapter 34. He's going to make sure that those people get what they deserve, and then, and only then, can we start talking about the wonderful future that awaits the people of God. Because you're not going to be left here. You're not going to be like the nations who have a one-way ticket to Sheol. This is not your ultimate destiny. And so when we get through chapter 33, chapter 34, and 35, you know, again, all this, you know, we still get this finishing off judgment language. When we hit chapter 37, everybody knows what that chapter is. It's the dry bones. Okay, it's about the resurrection of the nation. That is what we're headed toward. And this, again, when we get out of the oracles of the nations, which will be the next episode with chapter 33, that's the hinge, chapters 33, 34, 35, 36, because we're headed to the destiny of the people of God, not the uncircumcised. They're in Sheol. They got the one-way ticket. The unrighteous will remain in the realm of chaos. Okay, that's where they go. And Pharaoh's one of them. And of course, Babylon, you know, and other prophets are going to say Babylon's going to wind up there too, like Isaiah. They will never be part of the living again, unlike God's people, who will be raised at the last day. Again, that's where we're headed in the book.
All right, Mike. Well, we're making our way towards the end of Ezekiel. We're getting there.
Yeah, we're getting there. Telegraphing to listeners, when we hit chapter 40 through 48 is about the temple. We'll probably lump all those together because we'll just do Ezekiel temple talk in an episode or two of the podcast. I'm not going to numb you with descriptions of measurements. but it's a big subject because it's controversial, because a lot of people out there are thinking these chapters speak of, you know, the rebuilding of a new temple in Jerusalem that you know, maybe we'll get to see in our lifetime. And other people are, you know, other scholars are like, no, not so much. That's really not what it's about. So that's an important section. But if we lump all those together, we are getting close. You know, we're getting close to, you know, working our way through the rest of the book and finishing up with Ezekiel.
Okay, well, we appreciate it. And I just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.